Welcome. This is Sparks and Wiry Cries. I am your host, Martha Guth.
Sparks and Wiry Cries
curates opportunities
for art song creators,
performers, and scholars
through innovative initiatives that capture the stories of our diverse communities. Welcome to Sparks and Wiry Cries. My name is Martha Guth, and I am here with tenor Paul Sperry. We are finally sitting down for a long-awaited interview, and I'm really excited to share his stories with you today. Paul is recognized as an outstanding interpreter of American music, for whom many leading composers have written works specifically for him. He has many world premieres to his credit, including pieces by Leonard Bernstein, with Bernstein conducting the New York Philharmonic, that's the Dybbuk Suite, Jacob Druckmann's Animus 4 for the opening of the Georges Pompidou Center at Bolberg in Paris. That was in 1977. And then for the Paul Sperry and Bernard Rand's Pulitzer Prize winning Cantiga del Sole with the New York Phil, in 1983 under Zubin Mehta. These are just huge names, huge composers that he's worked with. But it's not just those composers that he's worked with. He's premiered works by Robert Beezer, Bill Bolcom, Victoria Bond, Tom Chapulo, Darren Hagen, Richard Hundley, Libby Larson, John Musto, Stephen Paulus. The list goes on and on. There's more than 30 of them. I'm going to guess, you know, many more than that. And I would say also near and dear to the heart of Sparks and Wiry Cries and what we do and what our mission is, he is a passionate advocate for American music. He has tried to ensure that many of the wonderful works that he's unearthed and supported will be easily available to others. And so to that end, he's compiled and edited and supported several volumes of American songs, anthologies, and single volume, single composer collections. And in 1989, he became the first non-composer to be elected president of the American Music Center, a national organization which provides information all over the world about American composers and their music. He's widely recorded, he's a professor, and he's also a friend. And I'm just so thrilled to welcome him here today. Paul, how are you doing?
I'm doing all right.
It's great to see you.
It's good to be with you.
So I have just a really simple question to start off. And it's, you've probably been asked this many, many times, but it's pretty basic. And it's just, how did you fall in love with art song and why?
Well, I fell in love with art song. I mean, I always loved to sing. And I've been singing in choruses. And I think I spent more time with the Harvard Glee Club than any chorus. And I also was very involved in the Gilbert and Sullivan productions that were going on at the time. But the art song thing, the first songs I heard were in my high school junior class. And the teacher was, he was really interested in the Baroque, particularly pre-Baroque and Baroque. And then the classical era, and we barely got into romantic music by the end of the year. And of course, that's the music I loved best. But he did play two Schubert songs, Errol Kernisch and Der Wanderer. And
in high school,
they were incredible.
Huh? What class was this?
This was Music One at the Putney School in Vermont. I thought, gee, those are amazing. And then sometime later, I got a recording of Gérard Souzet singing those songs and others, and Fauré's songs on the other side of the LP. And I was kind of hooked on those. I thought they were wonderful. I guess there was a summer. I spent 1 year in Los Angeles working in a plastics factory. And my family was very, very close friends with the cello and piano duo, the Groudons, Nikolai and Joanna Groudon. Joanna Hansi was a wonderful human being, marvelous teacher, great person, very good pianist. And the next summer at Aspen, she was supposed to be playing the Schönermüllerin. And she said to me, it would be a big favor to me if you would learn it and we could work on it. And so I learned the Schönermüllerin. I didn't speak any German, but they coached me on the German. And she had studied with Schnabel. She had lived in Germany, and her husband was a very meticulous musician. And we performed the Schönermüllerin. That was in baritone keys. And she was going to do it with a tenor, but it's all right. And we performed it two or three times. I had a wonderful time. I had taken some voice lessons while I was still in high school. And I did in college because I wanted to sing better in the glee club. But this was really exciting. And it took me a while. I went out to business school and sang in the business school Tycoons, which was a small harmony group. And when I just always wanted to do something in music. And by the time I was almost 30, I had to be singing. So then I quit the job I had and started trying to sing. But my repertoire started with Errol Kernisch and Der Wanderer, which I copied off of the Suzet recording.
Man, there are a couple of things I want to pick up on that. First of all, I don't know that there are many music teachers that are playing Schubert songs in music class in high school anymore. And so that sounds extraordinary to me. It certainly didn't happen for me. I know my music teacher did not do that. But also the fact that you didn't really start your performance career in terms of as a soloist until you were in your 30s.
And
you were business
at 35.
Wow. That's incredible to me. And I think it actually is really important for young singers to hear that this is something that can happen, really, in terms of the longevity of study. I think that's important to hear.
Yeah. Well, it was an unusual path. And I was, of course, told by my manager in Holland when I got one, the most depressing sentence I had ever heard.
Oh, no.
He said, "You can't sing songs for money until you're world famous, and you can't become world famous singing songs."
That is exactly what everyone gets told, isn't it? It's certainly from my generation and anybody prior. I mean, it's really, that is exactly what we were told, and it's exactly what we're trying to kind of combat, I think.
Yeah.
Sparks.
Well, I know in your case, you won the prestigious Wigmore Hall competition, and you should have had a song career going like that, but doesn't exist.
That's true.
And I was directed into contemporary music in 1970, and contemporary music in 1970 was overall rather forbidding. Mm-hmm. And I went, but then I was told by my manager in the States, Sheldon Soffer, who was very involved with composers, he said, "No, you're going to be good at it. You're going to enjoy it." And he was right.
Yeah.
But I was lucky in that I think composers didn't hear tenors the way they did hear sopranos, so that I wasn't going to go, it was just, it was much more lyrical in general, or dramatic and intense, but at least within normal vocal parameters. I mean, they didn't often ask me for things I physically couldn't do.
It's really kind of wonderful. You know, when I think back to the number of composers that you've worked with, the number of pieces that you premiered, and then also just the number of pieces that you supported along the way, in by offering premieres to other people through Joy in Singing, because that's another program that you used to head. you know, I really think that this turn in American music to more lyrical, singable song, art song in particular, has in part, in a small way, been led and directed by some of the work that you supported and premiered. And I'd love it if you would talk about that, you know, in a sense, because you have really, you know, by choosing the composers to work with, by choosing those pieces, and by working with those composers, I think that there's a direct line there.
Well, it may be. I would be thrilled to think so. Of course, for anybody who doesn't have devastatingly good at perfect pitch, 12-tone music is hard as hell to learn. No. For a singer, we can't put our finger on a note. No. So I had to work like hell on some pieces, and some I'm sure I never got it right. You know, I have a feeling that the way people think about tenors, even though I may not sound like that, and never did, but they think of, you know, G and DiStefano and wonderful songs as well as opera. And so maybe that was something to do with it. I don't know, but I also think that it was a question of the times. I was working with composers who were probably mostly a generation younger than I am, not Balcom, but Beezer and Musk and Paulus and Larson and so on. They're all 20 years younger than I am. They all started out being trained in 12 tone, and they all found a way out of it.
That's right.
They all struggled with it and in one way came to terms with it. Some, like Balcom, Musto, feel perfectly free to use it if they want to, but also to write in many, many different styles. Balcom probably more than anybody else. Mm-hmm. I remember hearing his piano quartet once at a premiere of it, and very, you know, this is a sort of a thorny piece, and right in the middle of the slow movement, there's a pop tune. Clearly a pop tune. And sort of, wow. So I think it was in the air. I don't really feel I take any credit for that. Bernard Rance, with that marvelous Canti del Sole, that's not a tonal piece, but it's post Debussy. It's not post Schoenberg. It's built on whole tone scales and things that you can identify with, and is not difficult to learn. And was just such a thrill to do. The only problem was he was writing it for an enormous orchestra, and there was no score. So all I had was a voice part.
Wow.
They tried to get Harriet Wingry, who was the best sight reader in New York, to do something with the full score to give me some idea of what would be behind it, but it didn't work. And so it was kind of scary to get up in front of an orchestra and never having heard the piece.
It ended up winning the Pulitzer Prize.
Yeah, which was particularly delightful because the critics ignored the piece. They only reviewed the Berlioz Sinfonia, which was an old piece, which was on the same program, at great length, and what a marvelous piece it was, and how blah, 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 blah. And then Canti del Sole won the Pulitzer, and wow, that was just a great moment.
That's fantastic.
What a thrill in my life. American music That's my language.
Yeah.
I've been asked so many times, what's your favorite language to sing in? Because I've sung in about 15.
Yeah.
And I always want to say, well, English, stupid.
But yeah, that's right.
When in the language that you grow up with, and that you live with every day, if you come across an unexpected word, you realize, and it has an aura about it, and you don't get that by translating.
That's right.
When I was working on Tchaikovsky's Shchum Lvabala, and I was working with a graduate of the Stanislavski method, and he said to me, of course, you realize what a special sentence Nijelium Splue is. And I would say, it is. I'm glad you told me. I'll try to make it special. But I'm not going to know that, even if I study the language. I'm not aware of the real subtleties of French or German, which I do speak. But, you know, you have to spend a lifetime in it.
Well, isn't that is exactly the case, isn't it? I mean, it gives credence to that kind of authenticity of the native speaker of whatever it is. And certainly in English, you have so much nuance and so much specificity that you can bring to a text. And it just is going to be better because that is exactly where you come from.
Yeah, well, always loved singing in my language. I love to sing in other languages too.
Me too.
And I work very hard and always go to a native speaker, an intelligent, literate native speaker, if I'm working on a poem. But I remember going to lessons with Pierre Bernac and asking about a very difficult Edouard poem, you know, what's it really mean? And he would go, pooh, with that wonderful French gesture that they have to shrug. And I decided, because my French is pretty good, I learned, if this helps anybody anywhere, that if you're having trouble with a French poem, try and think what they're looking at. So much of it is visual. That helped me a great deal.
Give us an example of that.
Well, I mean, to run a
Le Feu
du Soir, which is, I think, the greatest Poulenc song, and so did he. It's all about what you're looking at. Other places, it's not so obvious. The last song of Tel Jour Tel Nuit has visual things in it. But I always found that helps me a great deal if the poem is elusive.
Right. About working with Bernac. I mean, that's an incredible connection there to make.
After I got out of graduate school, I went to live a year in Paris, and after a couple of months, I got up my nerve and called Bernac. And I went and sang for him, and this is, you know, another one of the string of times when I was told, you have no voice, but you're musical. He said to me, what am I going to do with you? But he took me. He was a great musician. He was not a great voice teacher. He was a great music teacher. I learned how to sing French, but I learned how to sing. But I was awed by him. I thought he was amazing. I heard him sing only twice in my life, when he came to teach in Los Angeles, he became great friends with my mother. And he and his dearest friend and my mother toured together down the West Coast states. I met up for a little while. And I was tried to be helpful when he was running out of money and arranged the sale of some of his manuscripts to the New York Public Library.
Wow.
But his standards for what was musical and what was acceptable, I certainly can't agree with some of his things. He would never sing Le Chemin de l'Amour. That was not a concert piece. Mm-hmm. But or the children's song.
Cabaret, right? Yeah.
And Monsieur Sanssouci, which I love to sing. Mm-hmm. He never, no. And he didn't put them in his book. Mm-hmm. The song, complete songs of Poulenc without five important songs of Poulenc.
Right.
That was the way he was. He was extremely exigent. I was terribly flattered to be asked to be one of the 10 singers at his 80th birthday celebration at the École Normale.
Wow.
Along with Jesse Norman. And Suze, and you know, who have you, that had all studied with him, Ellie Ameling. I mean, those were wonderful moments. And I got to sing Chabrier. He asked me to sing Chabrier. And you know, I had such respect for him. He assigned me Chabrier, and I picked out four, I think is what I was supposed to do. And one of them was the Pastorale de Petit Cochon Rouge. And he said, "Oh, c'est ennuyeux. It's boring." And I said, in my youthful exuberance, "Not when I sing it." And I got a huge hand for it.
Great. Wow.
Because it's long and chattery and difficult in French. And, you know, I nailed it. And I felt so great. It's just wonderful. He asked me to call him Pierre. I couldn't do it. I just couldn't do it. I called him Matt. And I just couldn't. And I remembered a wonderful experience I had once. I had studied for a long time with Olga Ries, who was an elderly Russian woman, Latvian by birth. And, you know, it was kind of like family. And I was a fourth for bridge with Olga Ries, who was at that time maybe 80 or 80. Yeah, it wouldn't have been 80. She would have still been in her late 70s. Eugenie Harris, who was a dorm mother at Aspen at about the same age, and Rosina Levine, who was 92. Mm-hmm. And we had a bridge game. And afterwards, Olga said to me, "You know, Rosina wants me to call her Rose, to use with her the do, not the z. But how can you say do to someone so much older?" And I thought, wow, even 78 to 92, that's kind of amazing. But I had that kind of feeling about Bernac. I couldn't call him Pierre. Just couldn't do it.
I couldn't possibly imagine that either. I mean, there are just some people that just doesn't work for.
I don't think I ever saw him in short sleeve sport shirt. Mm-hmm. You know?
I'd love to go back just a little bit to some of the other composers that you worked with. Specifically, I really want to know if you see a new trajectory for art song now. Like, and what the differences are between what's being written now, sort of 21st, now that we're sort of like well into the 21st century, and, you know, the music that you were premiering 20, 30, yeah. 40 years ago.
I was doing a lot of music, as I said, by people who were getting out of the 12-tone box.
Right, right.
I was drawn to tonal music always. And I like things with tunes. And I would say, you know, some of my most favorite composers, some of the best pieces I wrote, I performed. I mean, the two works of Robert Beeser that I did were just incomparable. And certainly Musto, some of Musto is wonderful for me. I didn't premiere any Musto, yes, I did his orchestral piece. And it didn't have a big life, which is unfortunate. And Balcom's Open House, same thing. It was written for the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra. It had a very peculiar scoring. They only had one flute, two oboes, things like that. It didn't get picked up. It was a wonderful piece. Now, in that, he deals with every style, and the first two songs are hard as hell to learn. They're atonal stuff. And the third song, difficult to sing, but wonderful. And then there's a barroom ballad, and a rock tune, and a Western ballad, and a Bach chorale with, you know, in big overview. Wonderful piece. Balcom is, he's so steeped in every American idiom, and he just writes anything that the text suggests to him. I don't know, I haven't kept up enough with the songs that are coming out now to know widely enough to have a real opinion as to where it's going. I think basically composers are working in tonal framework largely, but how they're using it, how complicated, how, you know, there are big differences. There's still a wide spectrum of what people consider an art song. I hate that title, by the way. I think it scares people out of concert halls. I think that you know, just this is an anything goes thing, moment that we're in. All kind of what are called extended vocal techniques, some of which are hardly extended at all, like talking and whispering and maybe clicking your tongue, or, you know, who knows what, humming. I don't think it's crazy what people think of as an extended vocal technique. But I think people have moved away from the who cares what you think of the, you know, was it Davidovsky who said that, or I forget. Whether Babbitt or, you know,
right.
People want their music heard.
They want it heard. I think they want audiences to enjoy it, sort of a little bit, so a little bit more accessible in a sense. It doesn't mean that it has to be uncomplicated, right?
That's right. Yeah. Well, I'll take Tom Ciappullo as a favorite.
Exactly.
I adore Tom Ciappullo's music.
Me too.
And him. But he writes, it's not easy to learn, it is not easy to sing, but it is easy to listen to. It's wonderful to listen to. And I like to tell people that he's written some of the most beautiful songs I've ever heard, and some of the funniest.
That is absolutely true. Yeah, I mean, and his lines are fun to sing.
Oh, yeah.
They are fun and gratifying once you can get it, and it's it's truly wonderful.
I just think, you know, this is terrific stuff. Mm-hmm. I've had a couple of instances where composers have sought me out. Mm-hmm. I am a friend and admirer of Rob Patterson.
Yeah.
And he wrote me a letter which floored me. He said, I have in mind a song cycle that I want to write about a baseball player. And if you'd be willing to sing it, I'll write it. But if you're not interested, I won't, because I can't think of anybody else right now who would do it right. You know,
that's high praise.
So I thought, my God, I'm the only one who could do it right. Well, I'd love to try. And he went ahead and wrote it and has revised the title. It's now known as Batter's Box. And it's fun. It's a good, interesting piece. And he's written tons of songs since then. And I met Darren Hagen more or less in the same way. He wrote me a nice, flattering letter, and we got together. And you know, Darren writes some perfectly wonderful songs, some that are heartbreaking, like The Second Law, which is, you know, it's about a man dying of AIDS and his lover watching it. And tears you to pieces. And then he'll turn around and write something very cheerful or even funny. Or, I mean, he's like Ned Rorem. He can write any style he wants, and he does. So it branches. It's just like Balcom in that sense. He's highly prolific. When he was a Rorem student, Rorem told him to, over the summer, to write a song every day. And he did. Now, that, you know, that makes you understand Schubert or Wolf. Where did these bursts of energy come from? I mean, Schubert is incomprehensible. I just heard the quintet, the cello quintet again. How the hell? You know, I just to plug my favorite German composer, Benjamin Britten was awarded a humanities award by the Aspen Center for the Humanities. The first time they had such an award, they awarded it to Benjamin Britten, and he gave a talk in the tent at Aspen. And what I remember from that talk is he said, the greatest 18 months of Western music were the last 18 months of Schubert's life. And then he rattled off all the masterpieces written in that time. Not everything written in that time, just the masterpieces. So the Ninth Symphony, the Fantasy for Four Hand Piano, the three posthumous sonatas, I think the last three quartets and the cello quintet, Winterreise, Schwanengesang, I mean, just like that. And you wonder, how did he even have time to put the notes on paper? It's just unbelievable. And the quality, I mean, those pieces are staggering.
True genius, masterwork. Yeah. But it also sort of lends a really important point about just the essence of practice. That getting down and doing the work every day, no matter what, day in, day out, at some point becomes, you know.
Yep. Yep. Well, and he apparently did. He wrote in the mornings.
Right.
And then when walking in the afternoons and partying at night, and he had no money.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, listen, you said I don't like the term art song. So what is your definition of art song? What could it be? What should it be? Is it, should it be bigger than we generally conceive it? Should it be smaller? What do you think?
Well, I think it's a song for
just a song.
Piano and voice, written by, you know, but it's hard to say. I wish we had a word other than, you know, to distinguish it from a pop song. There are some masterpieces in the pop song literature.
Of course.
Tons of them. So I'm not sure I can answer that. I just think of it as, you know, I want to go hear a song or so.
Poetry set to music.
Yeah, it could well be.
Paul, thank you so much. This has been so wonderful. Thank you for this conversation. I think we could probably talk all day, but I know that we need to find a good way. Yeah.
And you can limit it too.
Yeah.
But it's always a treat, Martha.
Yeah.
And I'm so admiring of what you do and how you sing.
Thank you. Well, you know that I've admired you for decades, and the feeling is entirely mutual, and we are so grateful to you for everything that you have done here at Sparks, but also just what you have done for American music, and it continues. So yeah. We're grateful.
I backed into it, but it was the best thing that happened to me.
That's right. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
This podcast was produced by Jardana Gertler Jaffe. The intro was created by Ryan McAvoy McCullough. Special thanks to Erica Switzer, Julia Norelli, Lucy Fitzgibbon, Victoria Browers, and Neville Braithwaite. I am your host, Martha Guth. Sparks and Wiry Cries is a registered 501c3 nonprofit, and as such, we would welcome your contribution at any time. No amount is too little, and we really do stretch every dollar as much as we can to support the creation of new song, new performances, and new research. Please check out and subscribe to our YouTube channel to see all the wonderful creative content there, and definitely read up on the latest article releases and event listings on our website at www.sparksandwirycries.org. Thanks for listening.